I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. Coming up today on Current State, our show features beer, hip-hop, and game shows. Later, we're going to speak with members of All of the Above Hip-Hop Academy. The organization is working to foster art, education, and community through hip-hop fundamentals. Also, we take a look at a new documentary, The Michigan Beer Film, which chronicles the growth of the craft brew industry in Michigan. And Matt Ottinger of Quizbusters stops by to talk about the show's 25th anniversary special, which airs tonight. But first, as we enter the second day of partial government shutdown, it's still uncertain how much impact this will have across the state and locally. One thing is certain, however, the longer this continues, the greater the effects will be. More than 40% of the state's budget comes from the federal government. And even more locally, here in the Tri-County area, there are many nonprofits and government programs that rely on federal funding. A little later, we'll find out how one Eaton County housing program is faring. But first, we look closer here in Lansing. Ivan Love is executive director of Capital Area Community Services, which, among other things, administers the federal Head Start program for Clinton, Eaton, Ingham, and Shiawassee counties. The agency serves more than 1,600 children and employs nearly 300 people. Welcome, Ivan.
Good morning.
Also, we have Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson, director of the City of Lansing's Human Relations and Community Services Department, which oversees federal grants for a wide variety of programs throughout the city. Welcome, Joan.
Good morning.
First, I'd like to start with you, Ivan. Ivan, Capital Area Community Services operates Lansing's Head Start program. How many children do you serve, and in what capacity do you serve them?
Okay. Head Start is our largest program. Besides Head Start, we offer a whole array of other services, homeless prevention services, food distribution, emergency services. Our agency has at any one time between 50 and 70 contracts with the federal government, the state, and the city of Lansing. We have several contracts with. Our Head Start program serves about 1,640 children. It was cut a little bit because of the sequestration, so we had to deal with that last year. That is my big concern this week, is how the government shutdown is going to impact that. And if I can take a moment, I could explain to you the situation that we're facing and the potential crisis that this shutdown brings to a local program.
Yes, please explain.
The federal government, of course, I'd like to use an analogy first so people understand what the shutdown really means at the local level. We know that 800,000 federal employees have been laid off, and we know that the parks are closed and the zoos closed, but that's only the very tip of the iceberg. And I'd like to use the analogy, if all of us and all of your radio listeners were faced today with all gas stations in the country shutting down, the headline would be, all gas stations shut, 50,000 gas station employees lose their jobs, and they'll have some person talking about how they couldn't get their coffee at Speedway this morning. But that's only the beginning of the story, because all of us know that we need gas, and we all know that in our car we have a certain amount of gas, and we calculate in our mind, and we have a few cans in the garage for the lawnmower. But eventually we're going to run out of gas. And the gas for a program or an agency like mine or the city of Lansing that administers federal funds, the gas is money. And it all comes down to, when will we get the money, how will we get the money, and how long can we survive on that little bit of gas we have in the tank right now, which is the cash we have on hand.
How long can you survive?
Well, I don't know. We get funds one of two ways. Head Start is a direct drawdown from the U.S. Treasury. Other programs are reimbursed through the state or the city. So let's talk about Head Start, because that's my immediate concern. The federal government sent out a very short email that if you are an essential program, which they're now calling an accepted program, E-X-C-E-P-T-E-D, you'll be able to draw money down. But they didn't give a list of what those programs are. So I don't know if our Head Start program's included in that list or not. So today, We're going to attempt to issue $60,000 in checks tomorrow. we can only draw money down the day before we need it. So we're going to put in a request to Treasury at the end of business today for $60,000, and we will know at 12:01 whether it was put in our bank account or not. If it's put in our bank account, then we know we're one of the programs that they will fund. We're one of those essential service programs, and we will continue operating. If they do not put the money in, then I have to shut everything down Monday because I have a $600,000 payroll week from Friday, mm-hmm. and I will not be able to draw the cash down. And we have some of our own cash, but I'll have to go to the bank and borrow the money to make payroll, and we'll just have to sit and wait until the government resolves their problems.
What does shutting down mean?
That means I don't want to panic people because I won't know until tomorrow, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It may come, it may not come. But across the country, it varies. Some agencies, Head Start programs are funded about 8% of them each month. So they all start and end at different times. Those that begin on October 1, they're dead. They're not going to operate. They're closed because they can't get money. We started August 1, and so we may be able to still draw money down. And that we will find out. What I mean by closing down is I will have to give staff a layoff notice that not to report to work Monday, and we'll have to notify all the parents that we will not be operating Head Start due to the government shutdown.
Joan, the city distributes federal and state money to many organizations in the community. What are some of the agencies or services that will be affected by the shutdown?
Well, the biggest impact will be on homelessness. The $1.8 million that we receive from the federal government goes to ending homelessness. Ivan's program receives almost $400,000 for us for case management of individuals who are either homeless or on the verge of being homeless. So the concern that we have is ours is on a reimbursable basis. The city, when Ivan submits a bill, we do an immediate turnaround and reimburse them, but then we have to do a drawdown, you know, from the federal government. We have not been able to, or at least yesterday, we weren't able to contact our federal representatives. So we're kind of in the same situation that Ivan is in, and the worst part is it will impact on, you know, thousands of our citizens. This past year, 2012, we identified over 4,000 homeless individuals in the Lansing area, which was up, you know, from the year before. And we continue to fight that battle to end homelessness, but without essential services, people just can't survive. We give money, as I mentioned, to CACS. We have St. Vincent's Catholic Charities that does a permanent supportive housing program for us. Rent has to be paid for those individuals, utilities. We give money to Haven House, to Eves, the domestic violence shelter, a number of Avon House and a number of other agencies. So we're talking about thousands of individuals that will be impacted. Now, we've had another crisis that we've hit that is hitting us harder yesterday than the federal piece, and that was the Public Act 615 that the governor apparently signed in January. The problem there is in the city of Lansing, when utilities are shut off at any level, water, lights, or electricity, the houses are tagged and individuals are unable to reside in those residences. Our shelters have been full all year round. We've used money for moteling of individuals who, you know, have been put out on the streets or, you know, were evicted for one reason or another. There's no layer to add to anything that we're doing right now. The decision that Department of Human Services made to not utilize that 30% based on this Public Act to provide some emergency assistance is a wrong choice. It has nothing to do with Washington at this point. We're talking about our state government.
It's just another layer.
It's another layer that impacts on the poorest of the poor, or as as the Pope would say, the voiceless in our community. People are being sent in a maze, worse than finding this office, where they're calling 211. 211 is not able to identify a source in the Tri-County area to pay for any utilities. So we're really struggling. The mayor is involved, and we're meeting later this morning to try to figure out a plan. You can come up with a plan and a solution, but without the cash, nothing is going to change.
It sounds like a lot of stresses going on
right
now. I mean,
it really is. And when you talk about seniors and babies, you know, how can we do this? Kids need stability, and seniors don't like changes.
And Joan speaks to the other issue I mentioned we're very lucky that we can draw money down directly from the federal government for Head Start. Most of the things that I do and everything that that Joan does, someone else draws the money down for you, and then you get reimbursed. So many of the programs I operate for the state, they're sending me letters that I will not get any reimbursements after October 1st because they can't draw the money down, so they're already warning me and telling me, don't expect us to give you money. And I think one of the biggest impacts that that's going to happen nationally is I got a letter from Michigan Department of Ed. The Head Start children get a meal. We serve about 300,000 meals a year in the school lunch program. Department of Ed said they cannot reimburse us or any school districts, is what the letters basically said, until the federal government ends the shutdown and appropriates the money. So I cannot get reimbursed for the meals I serve the children in Head Start, even if I'm operating. Every school in the United States will not be able to get reimbursed for school lunch meals until this is resolved. So they'll have to find the money, and they'll have to operate. And for us, it's about $550,000 a year that we get reimbursed for the meals. And, you know, we can't get reimbursed for homelessness. And we're getting some money from Joan, but, I mean, from our state office, we're not able to get money because they're not able to draw it down. So, I mean, basically I'm faced with the decisions, how long is this shutdown going to last? Then we get into the debt ceiling, and I gave you a thing. I think Joan spoke to a real problem that's the backdrop. This was in the paper, and this is from the U.S. Census. And if you look at the city of Lansing, the first column is median income in 2008 in Lansing was $42,078. Today, or well, in 12, it had dropped to $33,760. A 20% drop in income for everyone, the median income in our city.
And what that did was to put the light on Lansing, saying that we had a 25% increase in the number of kids living in poverty, which puts it over 50%.
Yep.
And unfortunately, someone with the stats wanted to compare us to Detroit. You can't compare those numbers.
Those are oranges and apples.
I hope they're listening. Right, absolutely. But, you know, again, Lansing has made lots of positive impact in terms of employment, blah, blah, blah. The problem is that the people with limited skills, the jobs have not reached down to that level. So we have people who are trying to survive on minimum wage. A mother that I talked to someone about earlier, mother of seven, minimum wage, she's working two jobs and she still can't survive. She lost housing illegally, but children are suffering in our community. The city of Lansing this summer to fill that gap in terms of the federal free lunch program, we provided 3 weeks of free lunches, and thanks to the generous donations of citizens, et cetera. But again, we gave them one box, and they were accustomed to having two meals anytime that the feds are feeding. And then you go home with that box, and the family's trying to eat out of that. We have kids, you know, that are hungry. The shelters are up with their numbers feeding. I volunteer every Sunday at Advent House, and this past Sunday we fed breakfast to about 280-plus people. I mean, we did 15 pounds of grits in a pot. When the grits goes down, that's my loaves and fishes. I mean, it's trouble in a lot of ways, and you can't turn your back on. Kids don't understand.
Yeah.
And so we have a challenge ahead. We're rising to the occasion, but our hope in the city of Lansing is that the federal government, you know, will get their act together. You know, this is not a time for, you know, partisan politics. We need to address.
What would you say to them if you had the chance?
Oh, I don't know if I could say it on the radio. But I would say that, you know, basically, you know, where's your human compassion, and if this were your family, how would you respond to the decisions that someone else would make that would lead to homelessness or missing meals for a number of our kids? It shouldn't be a choice. It's doing the right thing, and what's happening now is not the right thing and is impacting on thousands, if not millions, of people around our country.
And Ivan, what about you? What would you say to Washington?
Well, you know, that's an extremely difficult question to answer. And I'm like Joan. I have my own personal thoughts, but, you know, we're on the radio. I personally think it ought to be mandatory that if you're elected to Congress, you have to go live in the community and live the life of people that really receive government services. Part of the number is for income is dragged down because we basically serve people that are in poverty. half of our children in Head Start are at 50% of poverty. So poor people are getting poorer over the last decade, and that's one of the factors dragging the number down. And I know some elected officials try to live on food stamps for a week or something, but until you honestly understand what families are dealing with and what's happening in our community, and if a policy that if you believe people should be drug tested to get food stamps, drug tested to be in public housing, drug tested to get cash assistance, and they test positive for drugs, there really is limited resources to serve those people, and I think you end up with individuals that are a new phenomenon in our city over the last 5 years standing on the street corner with cardboard.
But I think the bottom line is you don't let the kids suffer as a result of poor choices for the parents.
Yeah, and I think that's I used to, when I started this in the early 70s, the belief was we praise those that had a good job, a good income, and a good retirement. And we tried to make sure that everyone got that. Sadly, I think today, politicians and maybe more people than I would like to see in our nation say, I don't have it, so why should you? And it's a complete flip of the question, where we used to try to make sure that we praise those firemen and those teachers and those union workers that had the good job, the good income, the good retirement, the good health care. But now we demonize them and we say, I don't have it, so why should you have it?
Well, we'll be keeping in touch with both of you guys as the situation continues, and hopefully it's not prolonged for too long. Ivan Love is Executive Director of the Capital Area Community Services, which administers the federal Head Start program for Clinton, Eaton, Ingham, and Shiawassee counties, and Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson is the Director of the City of Lansing's Human Relations and Community Services Department. Thank you guys both so much for joining
us.
Thank you.
And now we turn to a local agency that's been having a slightly different experience with the government shutdown so far. The Housing Services for Eaton County is a nonprofit agency based in Charlotte that provides case management and housing assistance for low-income residents there. With me now by phone is Executive Director of Housing Services for Eaton County, Denise Dunn. Welcome, Denise.
Good morning.
Denise, your agency was recently awarded a one-year grant of about $170,000 from the U.S. Veterans Affairs Office to help low-income veterans who are either homeless or struggling to remain in their homes. The grant was to start yesterday. What is the status of it at this point?
Well, I received information last night after 5 o'clock that we would be able to incur costs. So we've been told that we can go ahead and incur the cost, we just can't get the reimbursement right now. So that's where I'm sitting with that. My gentleman that is the case manager is in Barry County right now doing some intakes. He did intakes yesterday. So we're going to conduct the business that we've been charged with here under this grant in good faith that the government's going to go good on paying us. We don't want any veterans going homeless or being evicted.
You are also the recipient of a special Section 8 grant. What is that grant for, and have you received the funding that was due yesterday for that?
Yeah, that's an interesting grant. About 10 years ago, under the Bush administration, there was a faith-based allowability, if you will, to go after those kinds of funds. And I got into that window and was able to capture a five-year mainstream grant. And that's been renewed ever since. So that money comes out of a different pool of money in Washington than the standard Section 8 that you hear about, like the Lansing Housing Commission. This funding comes out of funding for people with disabilities and seniors, which is called 811. I didn't know what would happen with that funding, but my bank account showed yesterday that they actually deposited the money that I'm supposed to have to pay rents for October 1.
Were you surprised?
I was surprised because I thought, well, it comes in on the first every month, and October 1, midnight, the government shut down, so would it show up? It actually was deposited, and so I have the funding to pay for the Section 8 program here in Eaton County, which is approximately $40,000 a month going out in rental assistance that assists 75 households. So a pretty big dynamic and impact there if we were unable to do that.
Yeah.
But last night I also received an email from the National Coalition for Low-Income Housing, and they said HUD's plan of action is to pay this. So across the board, it looks like HUD paid October 1 for everybody to pay their subsidies out, but they were unaware what would happen. So at this point, they're standing and just waiting. So if it goes on for very long, I'm not going to know.
Yeah, how will this prolonged shutdown affect you at Housing Services of Eaton County, if it's prolonged,
well,
that is, yes.
Yeah, and so the biggest impact, and I was listening to Ivan Love, as he stated, you're not going to be able to get these reimbursements, and that's exactly what's happening here with us. I have several funding sources from the feds that I always get on reimbursement basis, and yes, you know, just yesterday was the first, so I should be preparing my reimbursements for the month of September and turning those in. I can prepare them and have them ready, but the funding's not going to come. So fortunately, we have funding and money in our bank account that we've been able to save up over the years through fundraising just for this type of issue. And that's not true of all nonprofits out there. Many, many, many nonprofits are shoestring operations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to affect some of the smaller nonprofits that really provide a lot of work in the community.
Denise Dunn is Executive Director of Housing Services for Eaton County. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Recently, Michigan has seen tremendous growth in its craft beer industry. The growth is chronicled in a new documentary, The Michigan Beer Film. The project not only celebrates the artistry of brewers in Michigan, but it also captures the challenges they face. The film is a product of Kalamazoo-based Rhino Media Productions. Yesterday, I sat down with Kevin Romeo, the founder of Rhino and the film's director, and Nick Benitez, the project's editor. We started our conversations where most great conversations start. Over a beer. Oh, perfect.
Never opened a beer before.
Let's cheers.
All right, cheers.
We've got some Clink. Two Hearted from Bell's Brewery.
Two Hearted Ale for my homies.
And Kevin, you said this is the first Michigan beer that you tried, but you didn't necessarily like it when you had it.
Well, I didn't like anything about it at first because I was like a lot of college students. I drank what was cheap and what was available, which was generally something along the lines of Busch Light, Bud Light, and that type of stuff. And one of my best friends, his older brother, he brought over some Two Hearted, and I looked at it and I tried it. And in addition to seeing, like, I just saw it. It looks like it tastes like it looks like the label. Like there's a fish on the label. It looks disgusting. Why is there a fish on the label? I don't understand. Like I was dumb enough to think like, is this made from, like, fishy water? Like, why is there a fish on the label? And it just tasted weird to me. I didn't enjoy it at all. And the ironic thing now is that Two Hearted, I mean, anybody who's into Michigan craft beer knows Two Hearted Ale, and it's easily one of the highest-ranking beers on the planet, generally, and it's definitely in my top three.
And, Kevin, how did this idea – what was the idea that sparked putting together this film?
Well, basically – we own a small company in Kalamazoo, and we want to do things that are impactful and like people can connect with. So we do a lot of client video work, and I'd always been saying like we need to look at developing our own film product, or like create our own stories that we can create and have a product and then sell that and show that and share that with the whole world. And then someone, as craft beer fans, it kind of made sense when someone said, well, you should maybe talk to Bell's about shooting some of the renovation stuff they're doing. They should have that documented. And I was like, that would be pretty awesome. And I was like, but they're Bell's, and I'm just like not that well known as a video production company just yet. And I was like, but I wonder if we could start just slowly going on a journey of just telling the whole story of the state's just explosive growth and how we could kind of find a small brewery, watch them grow throughout the film, and just get interviews throughout the state and connect with people all over our state and see what the best way to tell that story would be. So
I joined in January of this year, and I was doing a couple video blogs for the beer film, just kind of behind-the-scenes stuff, and sat down with coffee with Kevin one day, and he was like, do you want to edit the whole film? And it was kind of like, whoa. I think I said sure, like I was too unsure about it, but it was definitely a great opportunity.
Now, this film is not just a PSA for, you know, Michigan beer is really great. You really took time to look at both the economic aspects as well as kind of the creativity and craft that goes into beer making.
Yeah.
Why did you think it was important to view Michigan beer through those lenses?
I didn't want to make it seem like we're just making a long promo video. So I thought, you know, people are discerning and they'll see right through that. I don't want to make it seem like we're hiding something. And that being said, it was really hard to not make it just really exciting and really positive because there's so many positive things happening. And the only negative thing that can really be talked about and does get talked about in the news in regards to Michigan beer is just the fact that there's so many. And is it going to become too crowded of a market? There's only 4% of the people who walk into Meijer and go buy beer are buying a Michigan beer. The rest of them are buying Anheuser-Busch, Miller Coors, or Heineken, or whatever. So there's only 4 out of 100 people are buying Michigan beer, yet we have 130-plus breweries in the state. Is that sustainable? That's the big question. But we don't answer it in the film. We let it kind of just the viewer decides for themselves. And we definitely encourage the people to watch the film that if you do like craft beer, stick to it. Keep spending your money on it and convert your friends and, you know, all that stuff. So.
What is the Michigan beer or Michigan brewer culture like? Either one of you guys can speak to this.
I mean, it's very much that automotive culture as well. It's that blue-collar authenticity, really. I mean, most of these guys really don't hide what they don't really hide anything. They just, most big guys, huge beards, listen to metal. They do. They're very unapologetic.
Yeah.
And it's great when something like that comes through in the beer they make.
I support Nick's answer.
Good. What is it about Michigan culture that lends itself to this craft brewer culture?
I think that there's a unique combination of ingredients that make Michigan a great spot for beer. And one, you can't deny that it's born out of innovation, and people are losing their jobs, and they're going to other things. And, like, people that would have been busy working their 9-to-5 before that may have got laid off are brewing beer now. And there's, like, an infrastructure being built. We have a really strong brewer's guild that's, like, very supportive of that. And we have Larry Bell. I mean, we talk about this in film, but you can't talk about Michigan beer without saying, like, Larry Bell's influence was huge. So many people, I mean, everywhere I went through the film, I'd say, tell me about Larry Bell. Tell me about Larry Bell's influence on you. And every one of them, without fail. And the ones, there was a couple that didn't, and those are the ones that kind of made me scratch my head and go, I don't know if you're going to make it. If you don't understand what Larry Bell did, I don't think you get it. But all the ones that got it would say, I wouldn't be doing this probably without Larry Bell, because his beer opened my eyes to the possibilities. And that just that spark of epiphany is what you go, oh, the beer could taste like this. Let me see what I could do, you know? In this era of, I mean, going back to the Michigan question, I think there's just a lot of pride right now because we've been down and out, and we want to see great things happen. And Joe Short says it in the film, really, in an interesting way. He says, Michigan's surrounded by fresh water. And, like, if you could draw a place in your imagination where breweries would pop up, it'd be a place surrounded by fresh water, and having that roll up your sleeves and go get it attitude, you know, I think that plays a lot into it. There's a million factors. It's very complex.
You guys traveled all over the state to make this film. Nick, do you have a favorite memory or place that you went while you were creating this project?
I would say, I think it was about, we spent 12 hours at Greenbush, just all day. And that was, it was, we showed up, what was it? It was the second anniversary party. And it was just all day. Got there, they have amazing beef brisket sandwiches. We had two of them that day. Yeah. And
we had lunch and dinner there.
I never thought I'd spend 12 hours in a brewery or a pub or anything, but that was pretty, it was a pretty interesting experience. We had to tag out and we needed a crew to come back in and tag out for us because we were just so tired.
You traveled also to kind of obscure places, Paw Paw, Michigan, and we have another beer from Paw Paw to try.
Yeah, we do.
All right, let's open these.
I love this beer. I'm not going to lie. Like, I love Two Hearted, and Two Hearted's my jam, if you will. And the thing with, where did our 1915
here we go.
Beer bottle
opener?
Here we go. What I love about this beer is that the guys that make it are genuine people. And it's a porter, and what's fun about a lot of porters is that they'll throw in like coffee flavors or vanilla flavors or chocolate flavors, and it just, to me, lately, I told you I've been basically taking a sabbatical from beer since we made the film.
Yeah.
This is a beer I've been craving, so thank you for letting me on your show, and I can have this porter.
All right.
Do you guys want to cheers?
Yeah,
me?
Let's
All
cheers.
Right, cool. I think you'll enjoy this beer, unless it, like, went bad somehow. And if it does, don't blame me.
Oh, you can taste that coffee.
Yeah. So
it's good.
I'm a big fan of this beer. And the cool part about this beer as well is that Paw Paw has become really good friends of ours. The ownership there is just really great guys. And they gave us, like, four cases of this beer to have at our after party for the Kalamazoo premiere of the film. So Ben said, Ben's one of the owners, he said, do you want a keg or do you want some bottles? And it was one of the more wise decisions I've made in the last year or so. And I was like, give me the bottles because I know we won't drink all the keg and we'll have leftover bottles of the beer. So anyway, little decisions that are important.
So the fact that these breweries are in places like Paw Paw, which is, you know, kind of not a big city, in the middle of nowhere in some senses, these aren't super large scale productions. What do you think this says about the aims of the brewers in the state? I mean, is money the goal in the end, or is it really something else?
You know, honestly, I think for them, money is a possible goal. But more than anything, and this sounds like I'm being super idealistic and trying to make these people sound like saints, but I really feel like, especially with brewers like Paw Paw and Greenbush and some of these ones that are in these small communities, it's really about community enrichment and having a pub be in the center of the community that people can gather around and have a conversation over beer. And I just think some of the most profound conversations happen over beer, and I think the people – especially like some of the people that we had in the film, they really get that. And it's at the heart of everything they do, just making beer that helps bring the community together. I mean, Paw Paw has – they do Community Bottling Day. And, yeah, it's an opportunity to get free labor. People want to help them bottle, and they like what they're doing. But you have a culture where people want to come and help you make your product, and they're willing to volunteer their time. Then you're doing some things right.
Nick, in the process of making this film, what do you think you've learned about Michigan beer?
Learned a lot. I mean, you learn about the people that make it, and I think that's most important. I mean, these people had jobs prior, and they hated their jobs sometimes, and you kind of learn about their second chances and how important it is to, you're not just drinking a good beer, you're supporting someone in the community. And that's, I mean, it's wins all around. Like, you're winning, you're drinking great beer, you're supporting someone. They're putting their heart into the beer they make, and so you can enjoy it, so you can enjoy a better beer than common X beer, you know?
It sounds so simple, but like that's a really good way to put it. Like, it's winning all around. Like, how many situations in life do you feel like this is where everyone wins?
What do you hope people take away from this film after they see it?
I hope, number one, that when people watch the film, that they feel that they understand the levels of complexity that go into the products that they buy. For me, that's always a consistent theme throughout life, is that every little thing you touch and experience on this planet Earth and your time here is created by something. And like this little silly stand that says, please don't touch the microphone, somebody had to make this. And I appreciate that. And it's easy to take advantage of things. And for me, people so quickly buy a beer, slam it down, don't think a thing about it, just want to get drunk or whatever. And I want people to appreciate the fact that someone from their state made that beer, thought about, envisioned what it could be, mm-hmm. set about to make it, completed the task, and then delivered it. And you are able to enjoy it.
Kevin Romeo and Nick Benitez, director and editor of the Michigan Beer Film, also members of Rhino Media Productions. They're currently working to book showings of the Michigan Beer Film across the state. You're listening to Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday, and it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we welcome All of the Above Hip Hop Academy. The organization provides youth the opportunity to learn the fundamentals of hip hop through mentorship, while also working to build community, a hip hop community in Lansing. Jose Moore is the director of All of the Above Hip Hop Academy, and Carl Bowers is a B-boy mentor for the program. Welcome both to Current State.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jose, so I want to start by talking a little bit about what role hip-hop has played in your life personally.
Wow. Well, I was introduced to it, you know, just at a really early age. You know, it's kind of the inevitable. It was around my cousins, my family. I mean, it was just there. I didn't find my voice in it until, you know, my dad, my parents got me a karaoke machine, right? Mm-hmm. And we used to record tapes and, you know, buy instrumentals and blank tapes and kind of record our own songs. So just before we even knew how to write songs, so we were recording these tapes and selling them at school for hot lunch, and just learning how to, you know, build support off of this newfound voice, you know. But it's been throughout the years. Not only has it given me an opportunity to have a voice and to be seen and heard, you know, which at the core of everybody, they want that, you know, to be, you know. You know, noticed, you know, to a certain degree or whatnot, but it's given me an opportunity to experience the world, you know, and I don't know if I would have had the chance to go the places that I've been, you know, between, you know, from Japan to Amsterdam, London, Germany, Spain, Ireland, and so on and so forth, experiencing hip-hop at a global level and seeing how each community has its own interpretation. Where some fundamentals remain, they also have their own spin on it. And so I just don't know if I would have had the chance to see as much as I've seen if hip-hop hadn't been a part of my life. So a very, very different experience than most in the culture. But, yeah, I'm thankful for it. Thankful for it.
And, Carl, what about you? How did you get introduced into B-boying?
Well, for me, it was started as a kid, like, not getting introduced to b-boying, but just dancing in general was something that I've always had a passion for, either it being, you know, from watching cartoons and picking up dances and going in front of my parents and showing them. But it started in high school with a group of friends, and I found out that they were dancing in this classroom, and I came and I walked out upon it, and I was like, you know, this is something that very, like, interests me, and so I began to, like, pick it up, and slowly it was just dancing to me, and it was something that I loved to do. But as it grew with inside of me, became more fluent with it, it became more of a passion for the culture and the dance, and something that, like, it's taken me to so many places and, like, enriched my life and just empowered me, and like, as an individual, just further than what I could imagine without it being there. So it's taken me, you know, now to places like here at MSU, being an instructor, to All of the Above and teaching youth there. So
you give up your career traveling around the world doing Hip Hop Jose, and you come to Lansing and found All of the Above. Where does the idea for All of the Above Academy come from?
It stems from I was doing a residency in Southwest Detroit, where it was my first time ever, you know, engaging a classroom with curriculum I had to come up with to reinforce, you know, English and social studies utilizing hip hop, which, you know, it's a perfect combination, you know, social events and, you know, talking about, you know, what's happening in society and building vocabulary, teaching kids the importance of having a vocabulary if you want to be able to rap and articulate an idea. You know, so they paired really well. But what I was noticing is that in the classroom, whereas, you know, every student there was required to be there because they have to be at school, there were a few students in the classroom who really excelled and had a natural gifting. And I had no way to, you know, point them in any kind of direction because I'm not from Southwest Detroit. I wasn't familiar with the different organizations there. But I didn't know what to, you know, if somebody didn't get a hold of this talent or if this talent wasn't nurtured, mm-hmm. you know, what would happen with it? You know, either A, it goes down the wrong path or it fizzles out and dies. You don't want to see that. And so here I am living in Lansing and the different things happening here in our own city, it seemed like the perfect canvas to be able to start painting this idea and bringing this to fruition. So at first we wanted to have a residency program, and then we shifted focuses from that with, you know, arts and the schools and everything kind of being, you know, shaky right now, to just developing a mentor program to where we can go out and look for these, you know, talented individuals who maybe aren't excelling at school, maybe don't have the best family home life, or maybe aren't jocks or playing sports and whatnot, but they have a knack for poetry, they have a knack for music and composition, and they, you know, they need an outlet. And so that's kind of where we're at right now, just trying to meet a need on a few different levels here in the capital city.
Carl, tell me about who you serve. Who's the typical kid who comes to one of your programs?
Well, I get an array of kids from different backgrounds and, you know, different demographics. And like for kids from 6 years old to 18 years old, and from kids with some disabilities, some with, you know, not. And just the kids, they come there, they're focused, and they love just, you know, the art of dancing. And I just take that and show them, you know, that this is something that you can be empowered by and something that can enrich your life. Like I said, these kids come focused, and they just love doing what they do, and I love teaching them. And so it becomes really easy for me to be able to do my job, you know, as an instructor when the kids come in and they have this love for dance already. So,
and beyond dancing, what are some of the other things that mentees learn in the program?
So we have an MC class teaching, you know, young aspiring artists how to rap, so to speak. But beyond that, how to find their voice, how to be themselves, how to perform, how to engage a crowd, how to, you know, structure a song, you know, how to, you know, the various different aspects of emceeing. Then we have a graffiti class, urban arts class, where we're teaching them, you know, the fundamentals. In each of these classes, we're giving them history too. So because it's a cultural, you know, approach to hip hop, it's not just this one dimensional all about the rap or all about the song that's on the radio. It's really about the culture as a whole. So you have b-boying, graffiti art, emceeing, DJing / beat making, and then it goes on to fashion, and it goes on to beatboxing, and so on and so forth. But really, we focus on beat making, graffiti art, emceeing, and b-boying. And in those, in each class, we're teaching them the fundamentals, you know, technique. We're teaching mm-hmm. them the history, where it comes from. We're giving them, I mean, we're bringing them back to the earliest pioneers and working our way forward, so they have a good understanding as to how this culture has developed and how, if you take it in for more than just what it can do for you financially or, you know, what's marketable, but how it can enrich your life culturally. You know, there's so many more elements and personal development, you know, points you can pull from. You know, so we have conversations about community and about what's happening in society, what's happening, current events on the news, and we give the students opportunities to talk about that through their craft or, incorporate that somehow into their medium of choice. Yeah.
I think there's kind of a negative stigma in a way that kind of surrounds a lot of people's understanding of hip hop, and in hearing about your program, they might think, how is hip hop going to help educate anyone? How is this going to improve skills and creativity? I guess what's your response to that?
Well, just like any culture, I mean, that question could be for any culture. You could say, how is Puerto Rican culture good for anybody? If you only highlight somebody who's Puerto Rican who is doing the wrong things, you know what I mean? So this culture has a language, it has a dance, it has a visual art, it has music, it has all these things that make up a culture. And so the best quote I've ever heard was one of Mos Def, and he says, if you want to see where hip-hop is going, you look where the people are going. Because, in essence, it is a direct reflection of the people who are making it. You know, and that's the beautiful thing about it, is that depending on who's at the helm of it, you know, or, you know, in the city or in their own life or being promoted on wherever they're at, you know, that's gonna kind of steer the direction of the content. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, because we're a program that is very much community, you know, centered and socially aware, at least tries to be, and at most really trying to be responsible with our position in the culture, because the stakes are just too high to be, you know, I just want to be an artist and that's it. I don't care who's support. I don't care what people are getting out of what, you know, I'm doing, as long as they're supporting me. We don't want to have that hyper individualistic approach to it. Mm-hmm. We want to stimulate community. We want to communicate global awareness. You know, so when we talk about what's happening in hip hop in Japan and what's happening in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. and, you know, just creating an awareness. And so, yeah, it's positive in the fact that it can empower folks to have a voice and move to action.
Very quickly here, Carl, how can people get involved with this program?
Doing free classes at the Oak Park YMCA, building community there. But we are also looking to partner up with a local arts organization. But we're now taking requests from, you know, different local organizations, from, you know, events to performances to workshops, and just helping build our community in the Capital area and around the Capital area. So, like I said, free classes at the YMCA. And for those who are interested in hip-hop, whether it be MCing, DJing, graffiti, or b-boying, say we welcome you to come out and try it and give it a shot, because it's something that can enrich your life, and it is like something that's, and helped me throughout the long run with mine.
Carl Bowers is a b-boy mentor at All of the Above Hip Hop Academy. Jose Moore is the director of the academy. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Today, the Vikings of Jackson take on the Hornets of Kersley. Now, here's the host of Quizbusters, Matt Ottinger.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks, everybody. Welcome to Quizbusters. Glad to have you aboard.
WKAR-TV's Quizbusters celebrates 25 years on the air this year. Since its premiere, the program has been hosted by Matt Ottinger. Quizbusters pits mid-Michigan high school students against each other on two opposing teams in the classic College Bowl format. Contestants answer questions drawn from the worlds of mathematics, science, literature, history, the arts, and more. Matt Ottinger is here on Current State in the studios. Welcome to Current State.
Emmanuel, thank you for having me.
Where did your personal passion for game show start?
You know, it was fun listening to the guys in the last segment, the hip-hop guys, and talking about how from a childhood this is what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I was laughing because you wouldn't think I would have much in common with hip-hop. But that was exactly it for me. When I was a child, I would take pegboards, cardboard, anything I could find, and I would build the sets of the TV shows that I was watching, and we would do game shows in the neighborhood.
What were some of your favorites?
Well, the original Jeopardy. There was a version back in the 70s of Jeopardy. Password, the $10,000 Pyramid, Hollywood Squares, all these old games that people my age are saying, oh, yeah, I remember. Concentration was another one. Fascinating stuff. All day long there'd be game shows.
How did you come to Quizbusters?
Well, I had volunteered at WKAR for years. Jeannie Krupp had brought me in to do some fun things. And WKAR decided that they wanted to revive a quiz game that they had done in the 70s. They were looking for a host, and they auditioned a handful of people. I was lucky enough to have the connection of having some association with the station, so I was allowed to try out, and I was lucky enough to be selected.
What are some of the skills that you have to have as a host that people wouldn't think are that you need to do that job?
I tell people my skill set is I can read aloud. That, for me, that's all it is. Now, people would say that there's more to it than that.
I would say there's more to it than that.
I think it's because I love the game show format so much. I'm just sort of instinctively attuned to what makes the game work. So I'm just instinctively doing that while I'm really literally trying not to trip up over some of the pronunciations of some of these great words that I have to say.
Yeah, the questions. I'm from the Lansing area. My siblings have both, two of them have been on Quizbusters.
Uh-oh.
And I've watched, and yeah, I would trip up on some of those words. I couldn't do
One
it.
One of the tricks is to say it with confidence, and most people won't know how to say it right anyway.
So you're good. So we have a Quizbuster special edition is airing tonight. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, to celebrate our 25 years and to give people a frame of reference, The Simpsons have been on for 25 years. So I'm just like Bart, except I age. The 25th anniversary special that's on tonight on WKAR is going to be adults. It's going to be local media personalities, business leaders, folks like Jane Aldrich, Darren Rockhold, the erstwhile host of this program. Mark Bayshore is one of our participants. Kathleen Levy from the Lansing State Journal, who wrote a great article in this morning's paper, playing the very same game the high schoolers do. It's a little more fun. It's a little looser. We all have a really good time, and people should watch.
How did the special edition guests do compared to the high school students?
They were fine. They were nervous. Kathleen's article specifically talked about how nervous she was doing it. And the kids are nervous, too, of course, when they play. But they stepped right up. And the best thing, and it's always something that's important when we're looking for the right people for these adult games, they were all very competitive. They wanted to win. They weren't just goofing around. We had fun. We laughed. We kidded around. But they wanted to win the games. And one of the games in particular was very, very close. So you got to watch to find out how that turned out.
Although this Quizbusters is a game show, at its heart, it's an educational tool, it's also a scholarship program in some ways, and it's a really special experience for these kids to get to be on TV and to be a part of it. What does it feel like for you to be a part of all these high school students' high school experience in some way?
Well, you sort of nailed it with that question. Quizbusters is a lot of different things, and one of the things for me is it's very special to watch these students figure things out, solve things in their heads, work out stuff, not just have stuff come in memorized, because we try to ask questions that don't key just to that. And then years later, I'll encounter kids, just they're not kids anymore, and they'll all come up to me, they'll introduce themselves because they realize I won't recognize them, and tell me what a great experience it was. Years later, I mean decades later now, and they always remember that experience, and that is very heartening to me. It's a very special thing to me that I've given them that memory.
What's in store for the future of Quizbusters?
I have no idea. Hopefully a lot more of the same. We've just started taping some of the regular shows for this season. Those start airing on Saturday the 12th. And it's still great. It's still a lot of fun. We have some cosmetic differences this time, a little bit of changes, but the game has been the same for pretty much the whole run, and I hope we don't ever change that. That's the fun part of it.
You were talking about earlier about your passion for game shows, but you weren't always just in the host, and there's also a participant side to you.
I was a contestant on two game shows, Sail the Century in the 80s, and then I was a contestant on Jeopardy in 2004. People remember Ken Jennings. Well, I remember him a little bit more than most. I had to play against Ken Jennings, who ended up winning 74 consecutive games. So unfortunately, I didn't do well on that, but it was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. WKR TV's Quizbuster celebrates 25 years. You can watch the special edition tonight at 9 o'clock. Matt, congratulations on 25 years.
Thank you, Emmanuel, very much. I enjoyed this.
That's our show for today. Mark Bayshore will be back tomorrow. The ship is still afloat, Mark. I'm Emmanuel Berry. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.